So I'll first say a word about how I understand the scope of the issue. Then another word about how I come to this issue. And then a third word about how I understand different starting points within the world of theory from which one might come to this issue. So first, how I understand the issue of do the laws of nature change. I understand it in one sense as a question about how real time is, how far down time goes. And I understand it in a second connected way as a question about whether real novelty exists in the world. By real novelty, I mean something that goes beyond the following spectral idea of possibility, that in addition to the actual world, there are possible states of affairs that are like ghosts stalking the real world, waiting for cues to walk on stage. Under such a view, there is no real novelty in the world. Real novelty supposes that the possible is not the antecedent to innovation, but just its shadow in thought. So we reorganize our understanding of reality after the innovation has been produced. Now, I think that the biological idea of emergence is either too restricted or too ambiguous to accommodate the radical conception that time goes all the way down and that real novelty in the world is possible. Now I come to my second word about how I approach these issues. I approach these issues from two perspectives. Perspective of thinking about society and history, and the perspective of acting about society. So first, from the standpoint of social theory, I am an adversary of what I take to be the dominant rationalizing, humanizing, and escapist tendencies in the whole field of social and historical studies. In the positive social sciences, rationalization prevails. The objective is to vindicate the naturalness or the superiority of the established arrangements. In the normative disciplines of political philosophy and legal theory, humanization prevails. The objective is to place a metaphysical gloss on compensatory practices such as the idealization of law or the redistribution of resources through retrospective tax and transfer that attenuate the evils of a world that we feel unable to reimagine and to remake. And in the humanities, escapism prevails. Consciousness embarks on a roller coaster of adventures and subjectivity disconnected from the practical transformation of the social world. If we seek in the history of social thought instruments with which to resist this disarmament of the transformative imagination, we naturally look first to the record of classical European social theory. And if we look at the most influential transformative theory, Marxism, we see what the problem is. The impulse is there to view society as an artifact, the social order as something that is made rather than given as a natural fact. And therefore to insist that the supposed universal laws of society are just the laws of a particular social formation. So, for example, Marx says that what are supposed to be the laws of economics are just, in fact, the laws of the capitalist economy. However, this impulse in the history of classical European social theory is undermined and constrained by a host of necessitarian assumptions. For example, that there is a short list of possible types of social organization, like feudalism and capitalism, that each of these types is an indivisible system that stands or falls as a single piece, with the result that all politics must be either reformist tinkering or revolutionary substitution, and that there are laws of historical transformation driving forward the succession of these indivisible types. All of these necessitarian assumptions have become literally incredible. No one can really believe in them anymore. They're bad guides to action, and they can't be sustained in theory. So then the question becomes, can we disengage the original impulse from this decaying corpse of the necessitarian assumptions and liberate it in some form in order to resist the rationalizing, humanizing, and escapist tendencies that now prevail in social thought? In the prosecution of that campaign, one question that arises is, what is the position of this effort in relation to natural science and the culture of natural science? A strategy of caution would be to claim some exemption from social thought, say this is a different domain to which different rules apply. But it may be less revealing and less fertile than a strategy that rejects the impulse to claim an exemption and invades the territory of natural science or favors reciprocal invasions to leave everything open in the hope that natural science, rather than being a constraint on this intellectual effort, could actually become an incitement to it. The second standpoint from which I come to this issue is programmatic rather than social theoretical. So I take the situation now in the world to be the following. The world staggers and stumbles under a dictatorship of no alternatives. After the great ideological and institutional adventures and calamities of the 20th century, there seem to be no alternatives. And there is now in the world a very restricted repertory of living institutional options that are available for the organization of different domains of social life. And this very restricted repertory is, in a sense, the fate of the contemporary societies. To escape this fate or to rebel against this fate would require the enlargement of the institutional repertory. And the enlargement of the institutional repertory has to be informed by a transformative imagination. And thus the connection between the programmatic interest and the social theoretical interest. We now suffer from a kind of programmatic aphasia. Stating or feigning interest in alternatives, but not knowing how to talk or to think about them. Now my third word, which is just to enumerate by way of example a series of possible starting points from which one might come to this issue in the sense in which I've described it in my first word, from within the universe of existing ideas. So here are four starting points, among others, from within the idea world. one starting point has to do with the implications of familiar natural scientific or cosmological ideas, as a layman might understand them. So it seems that there's something very strange about the relation between the now standard cosmology and the idea of the immutability of the laws. It seems that on the standard cosmology, the universe does have a history. And the laws that exist in this particular universe are not only contingent, but in some deep sense, historical. It's kind of like the American Constitution, which, having been invented in the 18th century as a historical artifact, is then treated by the Americans as immutable. So first they take it out of a hat, and then they treat it as the way things have to be in a democracy. Now, the second starting point has to do with the relation between, among the history of physics, the history of biology, and the history of social theory. So it seems that that our way of looking at this problem is colored by the view that biology is a kind of weak physics, and social thought is a kind of even weaker biology or natural history. But this view seems to be itself just a contingent artifact of the development of the history of Western science, 19th century biology having followed Newtonian physics. If one took the view that none of these forms of knowledge has any self-evident prerogative to stand as the supreme model of explanation, the situation might look entirely different. After all, the conception that the laws of reality can change is puzzling, but it is not nonsensical. That it is not nonsensical is demonstrated by the fact that, in a sense, this is how we already think about society. We think that the laws of the forms of economic organization change, and no longer believing in the classical necessitarian assumptions of Marxism, we think that they change, even though we no longer believe that there are higher order laws governing the transformation of the different types. So one might suppose that this way of thinking, already anchored and expressed in the present state of social thought, might be projected backward to the natural sciences, rather than being taken simply as a form of explanatory dilution or abdication. The third starting point has to do with the problems of time and causation. Now, although the idea that the laws of nature may change is not nonsensical, it does seem to suggest a conundrum about time and causation, an unresolved confusion in our ideas about causation and time. If time goes all the way down, then there can be no invariant laws. And there not being invariant laws, there is no stable framework of presuppositions for our causal judgments. They must all be afloat on this sea of historical transformation. On the other hand, if time is not real, then an assumption of our conventional conception of causation is not valid. There are no real sequences. There's only simultaneity. So everything really is as it would be in the eyes of God, in which all events are present simultaneously to one another and connected. It seems that our conventional idea of time and causation is that somehow time is real, but not completely real. That it goes down, but not all the way down. And there's no reason to suppose that this is the way the world really is, rather than just a convenience of our limited apparatus of understanding and of action. The fourth starting point has to do with an observation about the nature of consciousness and the relation of the nature of consciousness to this problem about whether the laws of nature change. So take the following view, which I'll just state dogmatically. Consciousness has two aspects. In one aspect, it is formulaic. It acts under rules that allow for repetitions. In another aspect, the consciousness is not a zombie acting as if under rules, but is capable of producing genuine novelty. The mind is not like a machine. The mind is like a man with a machine. So as soon as a person learns how to repeat an operation, he embodies the operation in the formula and then embodies the formula in the machine. And because his life is short, his whole object is to shift his time and energy as much and as quickly as possible away from the operations that are repeatable and that can be taken over by formulas and machines toward those that do not yet lend themselves to repetition. This is the whole object in the practical advancement of humanity and is the fundamental motor of it, of our practical progress. Now it seems that this whole idea of the timeless character of the laws is a projection of this first aspect of consciousness, the aspect under which it is like a machine and encases itself within a framework of formulae that allow for repetitions. But the second aspect of consciousness could also be projected outward, and we have an interest, a practical interest, in asking whether the world as it exists is hospitable to us as beings who are always capable of seeing, producing, creating, associating more than can be accommodated within any pre-existing framework of presuppositions. Now, the relation between these two aspects of consciousness, the formulaic aspect and the surprising aspect, is not fixed and cannot be described by some purely naturalistic metric. The more society is organized to diminish the distance between the ordinary moves we make within a framework of unchallenged arrangements and assumptions, and the extraordinary moves by which we challenge pieces of those framework, the more the second aspect of consciousness, the surprising aspect, will come to the fore. So the relative centrality of the second aspect of consciousness over the first, rather than being fixed as a natural fact, is itself a consequence of politics. That is the sense in which this metaphysical debate about the transformability of the laws of nature is in fact connected through many intermediate links to a central political issue today.
Wow, that's great. Wonderful. Lots of things to talk about. And I've been writing down some. To mention some things that we must go back to, everything you said we must go back to, but this issue of how much novelty is there, I know is an issue that Stu has in different language. This is an example of the same issue in different language, and we must go back to that. The antinomy, if you call it that, of time and causality, we must go back to slowly. And things. Okay, now what I'd like to do next is invite other people who were not written down or didn't indicate that they wanted to say something. If you'd like to say something with me. Anybody?
I mean, I didn't.